Welcome to Poetic Craft in Nimeter. You've dedicated this course, John, to your friend and mentor, Terry. Now, his real name wasn't Terry, was it?
No, it was what he insisted everyone call him, though. But his full name was Carroll F. Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-L-L.
So you met Terry when you went to Maine University?
That's right.
So tell us about why you ended up meeting Terry, because he wasn't one of your tutors.
Not at all. In fact, he wasn't in teaching at the time. He had withdrawn from active teaching, but he was still the head of the English department at the University of Maine at the time I met him. And it was a magical meeting.
But you met because you were bored. You got sent off to... Because you were in the top echelons of your year, you got sent off to some special meeting once a week where there was this elite group of students who were meant to be highly intelligent, and you were bored.
Right.
They all sat around talking about what?
Plato and Aristotle. And I had already torn through that whole crew by the time I was 16, so...
So you were 18 at this point, yes?
No, I was 17.
17.
Yeah. So if I could give a little background, it is quite a wonderful story, and I'm happy to tell it. I think I've told it two or three times.
I get you to tell it a lot because I think it's a charming story about you and about Terry.
I don't know about a lot. How many times have I actually told it? Three or four.
Does it matter?
Anyway, this is probably the last time I'm going to tell it, and in any case, it will be recorded. We haven't recorded it before.
Never, no.
So the background of the story, which I'll give very rapidly, is that I graduated from high school in June of 1963, and I was a top scholar by national standards in the 99th percentile of the whole country.
So you got a scholarship then?
No, I didn't. My situation was problematic. My family was based in Friendship, Maine. My stepfather was a lobster fisherman, and he did not make a great deal of money each year. So we were relatively poor. And it was my wish to go to New York University when I graduated from college, from high school. So in September of 63, I wanted to go to New York University, and I actually applied to New York University, and I was admitted. But to my absolute dismay, I remember I was hugely devastated, although I shouldn't have been surprised that I couldn't go to New York University because I couldn't afford it. I even talked to the admission office. I called them on the telephone. And they said, well, you highly qualify, but you know, this is how much it costs to go to NYU. So what ended was a default situation where I ended going to the University of Maine on a scholarship because I was from Maine and I was a high-ranking scholar, and so I got in for almost nothing. So I find myself at the University of Maine in September of 63, October, November. Fast forward to when Kennedy was assassinated, I was there. And one of the first things that I encountered when I got to the University of Maine was, you're what we call an honors student. That's a technical term. And we have what's called the honors course. It still exists today, I believe. And the honors course is like special treatment for really smart kids. So we're going to put you in the honors course with these other 8 or 10 people.
What were you reading?
Well,
at college.
What was I reading in the course?
What were your majors? You call it majors in America.
I reading?
Yeah.
I had a lot of problem determining my major and minor. And I can't actually remember what I chose, honestly. So in my first year in college, I had to choose a major and a minor. I can't honestly remember. I think I probably chose as a major English literature. I remember I was looking very seriously at learning Russian, and they taught Russian, you know? But no, I was inclined toward English literature. And Terry, it turns out, was the head of the literature department at the University of Maine. So anyway, just to get back to the background, how I met Terry, I was told that 2 times a week, I think it was on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I was not going to go to a class, into a classroom. I was actually going to go to a lounge in one of the student dormitories. And this lounge was like a lounge. It was a big open area, and it had these very sumptuous modern type lounge chairs where you could like slump back in the lounge chair. And that's where we were going to meet the professor who led the honors course. And we were just going to sit around, superior beings as we were, and chat with the professor about Plato and Aristotle and philosophy and all these haughty, elevated subjects, you know. So I ended up in the honors class. I go to this lounge. I'm sitting there. And the leader of the honors group was a man called Cecil J. Reynolds. And you can find him on the page for the University of Maine. He was a revered figure of the faculty. And it was like, so there we were with Cecil J. Reynolds. And we were talking about Plato's dialogues, and we were talking about all these things. And I was bored to the teeth by all this. And I was also uncomfortable in that atmosphere. It had an effect, the opposite of what it was intended to do, right? Obviously, it was designed to have all of us bright kids sit around and chat with each other and get it on with the professor. And I was like, totally like in James Dean, sullen, you know, rebel, just shut the fuck up. I don't want to hear anything you have to say. So after about 2 months, Professor Reynolds noticed that my behavior was anything but congenial to the group. And so he took me aside after one session. It was at 2 in the afternoon. And he said, well, you know, he held up this paper and he said, well, this is the first paper I've required of the group, and your paper is absolutely brilliant. I just don't know what to say about it. I would like to talk with you about it, but I can see that you're not enjoying this group, so I'm going to advise you to do something. And I said, sure, what's on your mind? And he said, well, I'm going to ask you to go to meet this other professor in the English department. And he doesn't teach classes anymore, but he's retired. He's the great eminence of our department. And just go meet him and see what happens. I've told him that you're going to come and see him. So next Thursday, instead of coming in at 2 o'clock to see me, go see Professor Terrell. So it's probably in November, in winter in Maine. And I remember wandering off, had to find where his offices were, climbed up 2 flights of stairs, met his receptionist, who turned out to be a significant female figure in my life, and I go into Terry's office. And he's sitting there behind the desk and just looking at me. And I sit down, and it's quite awkward because I didn't have any inclination to talk to anybody. You know, I was quite happy keeping to myself.
You struggled with your social skills a lot at that age, didn't you?
Totally. I was always socially very inept, certainly due in part to an innate disposition, which I shall not name, but also due in part to the fact that I grew up in Friendship, Maine, where there's no social life. I learned no social skills from my environment. So anyway, I'm sitting there and we're trying to make conversation. We're trying to break the ice. It's quite awkward. And Terry's sitting behind his desk. He has books around him. He has things piled on his desk. And I look on his desk, and off to the right, there is a manuscript, a stack of papers, like a novel in TypeScript. And I look over at it, and I see that the title of it is Midnight on the Emperor's Pavement. And so I looked at it, and I said, oh, Midnight on the Emperor's Pavement. You know, that's Yeats, huh? And then I proceeded to recite the a stanza from Yeats' poem, you know, which is where that line is taken from. So I just did that spontaneously. I didn't do it to impress him or to prove anything. I knew the line so well, you know. Midnight on the emperor's pavement breed flames that no faggot feeds, no steel has lit, you know, and I read this whole thing. I recited it because I knew Yeats by heart. I knew dozens of poems of Yeats by heart. And as I'm reciting this, I'm looking at Terry, and he did something that he often did, which was something that deeply endeared him to people. He turned red. Something that Terry used to do is he used to blush when he was pleased. And literally, you could just see he would turn red. And I watched his face, and he was beaming at me. And he just turned red in front of my eyes. So, you know, I ripped off these 8 or 9 lines from Yeats. And I, you know, and he said, "Oh, well, you read Yeats, do you?" And I said, "Ah, I used to." And that was it. We were on like gangbusters from that moment on. He laughed until he fell out of his chair. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. Some 17-year-old punk kid, shut down, alienated, coming in and saying, "Yeah, I used to read Yeats." Yeah. And that was it. And from that moment on, we were like fire.
So he told you, "Okay, don't go to that... don't go to the lounge anymore. Come and see me instead."
No, we talked, and he explained to me, by the way, what the manuscript was about. He told me, he said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "That's a play I've written. I'm going to take it down to New York and show it to John Schaffner. You know, he's married to Perdita, who was the daughter of Ezra Pound." And that's the first time I ever heard the name Ezra Pound pronounced. It was the first time I went into Terry's office. Subsequently, I learned that he was among the world-class scholars of Ezra Pound, an expert, and he taught me a lot about Pound. So he said, "Yeah, I wrote this play. It's based on life of Christopher Marlowe. Do you know who that is?" And he says, "Don't answer. I know you do." And he said, "Well, you know, I think Christopher Marlowe was a fantastic person of the British Renaissance, the Elizabethan period. He was a very famous Elizabethan playwright who wrote a play called Dr. Faustus. And I adopted Christopher Marlowe's life into a play, and I'm going to take it down to New York and see if I can get someone interested in it." It actually turned out that some months later, I went down to New York with Terry. He drove us down in his Corvette. And we went to New York together while he went to see John Schaffner to see if Schaffner would be interested in that play and another book that he was writing. So we just hit it off at the beginning. And at the end of this first conversation, Terry says to me, "Well, you know, I'm not going to send you back to the honors class. I can tell you don't like it there. And Cecil told me that, you know, you're a troubled student, and maybe we should consider special treatment for you. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You come here at 2 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays to my office and sit here and talk with me about whatever you like, and I'll give you a 4.0 average on that course." And that was a deal. And he did it. And that was the beginning of our relationship. It was truly wonderful. I was so fortunate to meet him. And then we picked it up years later.
Yeah, you met him quite a few times, didn't you?
Well,
after you'd left.
Yeah, the fact is, you know, I dropped out after.
Did you talk to Terry about you dropping out?
Yeah, I did. And he just totally accepted it. You know, he never judged me. It was an extraordinary experience for me as a young man, a teenager, on two counts. First of all, there was somebody that I could talk to in and out about every conceivable aspect of English literature and American literature and all the poets, Tennyson, Yeats, Dylan Thomas, you know, I was on home ground. But even better, really, I mean, he just enjoyed my company. and nobody enjoyed me. You know, I'd found nobody who could enjoy me really very much, and that was for me a total revelation. So then he actually facilitated me in leaving, because when I told him I was going to leave, well, they threw me out for not attending classes, which was an outrageous thing to do to an honest student. And they did it in a very dishonest way. I won't go into that, but it was very dishonest. And I got expelled is the end of the story. So coming on to March or April of 1964, I graduated from high school in 63. I'm leaving the University of Maine, you know, banished, shunned, driven out. And two significant things happened at that moment that decided my direction in the future. One of them was that I had a classmate in the dormitory that I lived. I can't remember his name, but he was on the same floor. And one day I came back to my room after I had heard that I'd been expelled, and he knew about it and everyone knew about it. And you know, on the door of the room, there was a place to put in a card. So generally you would put in the card of the two students that were lodged in that room. Well, there was only one student in my room because no other student would lodge with me. So I came back one day and someone had taken a clipping out of the Village Voice, which was a newspaper from New York, very avant-garde, and it said, Europe, $110 by freighter. And that clipping actually led me to Jugolinia, which led me to book on to a freighter, which I took to go from New York to Tangier, and that's when I began my journey. That's when I left the United States, escaping from the draft, by the way. Because as soon as I dropped out, they tried to draft me. So that was one clue that led me in my direction, amazingly. The other thing was that Terry said, oh, well, what you going to do? And I said, well, I think I'm going to go down to New York City and go to the offices of Jugolinia, which is a Yugoslav freighter, and they take passengers on their freighter line, and I'm going to go to Europe. And he said, oh, great. Well, I know somebody in New York, and you can stay with them while you go down there. So he gave me a reference to New York. He was completely supportive. Gave me a reference to somebody he knew, and I stayed with this person in their apartment until I got on that boat and I left the country. Well, that was May. That was June, actually, of 1964. And, you know, I never forgot Terry, but I went on a very, very long journey. I never went back to Orno until I got back from that long journey. I met Jan Kerouac, and I went back to see Terry in Maine before Jan and I left for Mexico to get some money, babe. So he gave me $100. He's the only person I knew who would give me any money. But then from that point on, I didn't see him for a good many years until we had a most wonderful reunion some years later.
He was the first person to publish you.
That's right. That was a result of our reunion. I got back in contact with him when I was living in Santa Fe around 1982. So we're talking about 64, 74, talking about 18 years later. Somehow I got back in touch with Terry. That wasn't hard to do. He was still at the University of Maine. And it so happened that Terry was coming to the West Coast. He went to California to give a talk with M.L. Rosenthal at some prestigious academic event. And then he came to Boulder, Colorado, to talk at the Naropa Institute. So I have a connection with Naropa because that's connected with Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and all these people.
Not that you're connected to
them. Not that I'm connected to them at all. It's peripheral. So anyway, it was cold, cold, ice cold winter, November in Santa Fe. And I got on the bus. And I took the bus to Boulder, Colorado, and it was so cold and icy that the bus was fishtailing all the way to Boulder. And I got off the bus the next morning in Boulder, and I went to a house, and who opened the door but Terry? And that was our reunion in Boulder. I walked into that house, and we talked nonstop for 16 hours without sleeping, without eating. So I hung out with him in Boulder for a while, and I went with him. I met Ann Waldman, people will know who that is, and other people at Boulder, and he gave a talk to some Boulder students, and I joined in, and then I went back to Santa Fe, and then he came down to Santa Fe to see me. And that was a great moment. So I'm in Santa Fe at La Vereda off Palace Avenue, and I'm in my studio in the back of my apartment, which is a glorious place where I gave courses in alchemy, Gaian alchemy, and astrology, and lectures and things like that. And there is Terry and I for 3 or 4 days. Jan was there too. And we were talking about poetry. Well, I showed Terry some poetry that I'd written. And he said, "Wow, this is not poetry." He says, "You really want to write poetry, there's one thing that you have to know."
Take a breath.
Take a deep breath. He said, "You have to know about the shape of the line." And when he said that, I was completely electrified. And so he showed me what that means, and I reveal that. I impart that in the poetic craft on Nemeta. He gave me this tool. It really is a tool. And then I started to write poetry. And I wrote something called Runes Against the Shoreline, which later morphed into translations from the Andromeda. So at that point, we talked about many, many things. And one of the subjects that came up was what Pound scholars call the DMP. And DMP is short for Donna Mi Priega, which is Italian for A Lady Asks Me. So we were talking about this poem. This is a very unique poem, an extraordinary poem composed in a Tuscan dialect of Italian in the 13th century by Guido Cavalcanti, who was the guide and mentor of Dante. So at this point, Terry is literally pouring out to me hours at a time his profound knowledge of Ezra Pound and what Ezra Pound taught and how Ezra Pound was the great shining light of American intellectualism and literacy at the beginning of the 20th century. He showed me the cantos. He read me the cantos. He explained how Pound was captured by the Americans and put in a cage for being a traitor. And it was just, he opened an incredible perspective to me of so many things. So to cut to the chase, there was an event that happened at that reunion in Santa Fe in that cold winter in my studio that led to me being published for the first time, I think, seriously. I had been published a couple of times before that, maybe, in like anthroposophical journals or something. Terry was someone who could cook, who could run several kitchens at the same time. He was not only the head of the English department at the University of Maine, he was also the head editor of 3 different journals dedicated to Pound scholarship, one of which was called Paiduma. And he was the editor and director of the NPI, or the NPR, the National Poetry Foundation, the NPF. And they published all kinds of books about poetry. He's just all the time working. He was a workaholic, and he loved everything that he did. He was always glowing and beaming. When he showed you something, he would give it to you like it was a cake that he had made in the kitchen. "Please taste this cake," you know. Introduced me to Basil Bunting. I mean, so many poets. It was just an incredibly rich fare. So when Terry was ready to go back to Maine after that meeting, he said, "Well, I'm going to send you a bunch of stuff. You won't believe what he sent me. Most of it is in the Ambergain archives. He sent me all the books that were published by the MPF. He sent me tons of stuff. He sent me volumes of Paiduma and the other journal he founded. And we ourselves were going to found a journal called Arcanum. We talked about that, about even founding another journal. And the Arcanum was going to be about the occult roots of modernism and the Euro-American intellectual tradition, which Terry deemed me able to, to support that. None of that happened, but one thing that did happen was he sent me all of these things, and I'm reading the articles in Paiduma about Pound and Cavalcanti. I'm reading The Spirit of Romance by Ezra Pound. And one day, I'll never forget, it was like in the following spring, I think it was the spring of 86 or so, I got up and I thought, fuck, the DMP. I can translate the DMP. Terry told me that there were 50 translations of the DMP. And he'd read about 8 of them. And I said, well, fuck that. I'm going to translate the DMP myself. So I sat down with an Italian English dictionary, remembering the Latin that I learned in high school, because Tuscan Italian is very close to Latin. And I translated the DMP, which you find used to be on Metahistory. It's now going to be on Nemeta. And additionally, I wrote an essay, a commentary on the translation. And I just did it for the sheer thrill of doing it. I mean, I was in such a high from meeting him. It just poured out of me. And I sent it to him. And he wrote me back to the, in those days, we wrote letters. There was no internet. He wrote me back and he said, it's the best translation of the DMP I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I'm going to publish it in Paiduma. And so that's how I got published for the first time.
So Terry died when?
I think he died in November of 2003.
How old was he when he died?
I don't know. I'd say he's in his late 70s. The last time I saw him, I actually went to Orono, which is where the University of Maine is located. And when you drive to the University of Maine, you drive on a road that runs parallel to this beautiful, beautiful river called the Stillwater River. So on the right is the campus of the University of Maine, and on the left is the Stillwater River, and there are some houses along the river, and that's where Terry lived. So I went to see him. I saw him the last time, sometime around 1996. And as I understood, he died 7 or 8 years later. So I did get to see him in his house and talk about certain things. It was a wonderful experience to have him reach over and pull out that monstrous volume of the Cantos of Ezra Pound, which is about, 4 inches thick, and read the Cantos. So it's all a very, very great episode of good fortune in my life to have known Terry.
And not go to the University of New York.
And not go to NYU.
The question I've asked you before when we've talked about your relationship with Terry, how come Ezra Pound's, what should we call it?
Yeah, what do we call it?
Truth-telling about the Zenosh didn't come up. I mean, the man was locked up in a cage for broadcasting what was deemed anti-Semitic information.
No. He was locked up in a cage for broadcasts that were favorable to Mussolini. That was the charge. And the charge was treason. And Ezra Pound actually would have been executed for treason if he had not pleaded insanity. So Terry told me that story. He told me the treason story.
But
he didn't tell me the other story.
So it just didn't come up?
It didn't come up. No. So, just in case anyone doesn't know, Pound was brought back to the States in chains, I believe, and he was put up for treason simply because he gave some talks on Italian radio sponsored by Mussolini in favor of Mussolini. Therefore, he was an evil fascist. Well, today, you can go on the internet and you can find those talks.
We've been listening to them.
And I defy anybody to listen to these talks. They are so sane. And they address what 70 years ago he was addressing problems that people are only waking up to today. And among one of those problems was the JQ. But the JQ never came up, and Pound's views on the Jews never came up in my discussions with Terry.
Strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But we were mostly on the vein of the troubadours and, you know, literature. We were not on the vein of Pound's political views.
And yet Pound wrote some of the cantos in that cage that wasn't even big enough for him to stand up in.
The Pisan cantos, they're called, is a group, a section of the cantos that he wrote when he was locked in his cage like a dog. That's right. So what happened was that I don't think, I may be wrong, but I don't think that Terry himself ever went to visit Pound at St. Elizabeth's Asylum, where he was confined for something like 12 years because he pleaded insanity rather than be executed as a traitor. And then he was eventually released from St. Elizabeth's. But Terry used to tell me anecdotes about Pound that he had heard from people who visited him in St. Elizabeth's, most notably the Boston poet Charles Olson. And he gave me a book of Charles Olson's conversations with Ezra Pound. So I was like really an insider in that whole movement without actually being in the movement. But thanks to Pound, thanks to Terry, I know things about that movement that you could only know if you were deeply embedded in it. And it has really influenced my view of things and the way I teach and the way that some of the themes of Nemeta are developed are deeply influenced by this wonderful connection. But no, the specific subject of Pound's view on that ethnic tribe did not arise in my discussions with Terry. So, thanks for asking, by the way, for me to relate this anecdote. Obviously, it means a lot to me, and I'm happy to have it on record for anyone who cares to listen.